Hello, everyone. Let me start by saying we appreciate you taking the time to join us for today's Cinzi Spotlight. My name is Edward Morales. I'm the client partner here at Cinzi. So I will moderate today's exclusive discussion on the future of palliative and hospice care. Our esteemed featured guest today is Jody Holmes Dion. Jody is the Director of Operational Consulting for Hospice at WellSky. She has been a leader in the home health and hospice industry and palliative care for 33 years at various home health and hospice organizations, as well as health systems. So with that, she also has a master's in physical therapy. So we're very excited to have Jody take the time to be with us to share her insights today. And today's virtual event, just a little bit of housekeeping here, is being recorded. And that recording will be sent to everyone either tomorrow or the latest early next week. So for those who have joined us live today, welcome. And just to note that all participants for the time being are in fact muted. So if you do have a question, please use the Q&A tool in this webinar platform, and we will respond to the questions at the end of this session. Okay. And so with that, today we'll cover just a couple of agenda items here, which is the role of palliative and hospice care, and a variety of relevant topics, including staffing in hospice, extending the clinician's reach, value-based purchasing, and the quadruple aim, among others. And so with that, excited to get this thing kicked off here and get started. So I'll go ahead and turn it over to Jody for more on today's spotlight topics relating to the future of palliative and hospice care, starting with the relation to one another and the distinction between the two. So thank you so much, Jody.
Thank you. For a reference point, palliative care is really an umbrella term for comfort care. It covers patients at any stage of illness, and although care is comfort-centered, it allows patients to receive curative treatments, and this includes aggressive pain and symptom management. Prognosis, or end-of-life prognosis, is not necessary for palliative care. As far as hospice is concerned, it falls under this umbrella of comfort as the goal, but when the patient's prognosis is estimated to be 6 months or less, should the disease run its normal course. All curative treatments are discontinued, but treatment is provided for comfort around their various symptom management issues. The care is then shifted from managing the disease to managing the person using a holistic model to maintain comfort and dignity and decrease troublesome symptoms at end of life.
Yeah, so with that, I know we're gonna kind of jump into it here, but by way of palliative care versus hospice care, I know you have a very extensive and lengthy resume going through this. Can you talk to us a little bit more about what you do today with WellSky?
Sure, I'm currently the Director of Hospice Operations and Consulting for WellSky. So that involves me interfacing with a lot of front-facing agencies. I started actually with WellSky in the fall of 2020. And prior to that, I'd been an executive director of many hospices, and certainly like many of the people probably on the call today, have led an organization through the COVID pandemic that obviously continues today. And so I have some very unique experiences from that standpoint. So front-facing agencies, I do obviously a lot of education out there to help agencies continue to do best practice.
Okay, perfect. Thank you for the insight. And with that, you talked about a little bit touching on the pandemic and how things have changed and how things have evolved over the last year or so. Mm-hmm. I could even say running up on a year and a half. Where does the time go? But certainly things have evolved, they've changed. We've seen the evolution in all aspects, in all verticals of healthcare, and certainly in the end of life stages with hospice and palliative care. So with that, talk to us a little bit more about the evolution and what you've seen during the pandemic.
Yeah, there's been so many changes, right? So during the pandemic, hospice had to prioritize the utilization of technology in really all aspects of service, from direct patient care to family communication to bereavement services, even veteran honorings that we were doing at my last agency. In addition, front-facing staff have experienced really unprecedented personal and professional stress. The emotional support of patients and loved ones became more complicated as they dealt with challenges of isolation, really fear, depression, and really the trauma of the COVID pandemic, and obviously end of life, which is always challenging as well. And leaders had to become even more adept at managing staff support, compassion fatigue, burnout, and even turnover. And for many hospices, they had to learn for the first time how to actually operationalize their emergency preparedness plans outside of having a binder completed. And my role at many times in organizations has been around that safety officer, and we've worked really hard on those plans, but even the best plans out there didn't account for some of the issues that we saw arise during the COVID pandemic. So we learned a lot.
Yeah.
And hospice had to be adept with their marketing and outreach because our community liaisons, our clinical liaisons were no longer able to, you know, go into buildings and have the same contact. So they had to have new strategies to reach patients who were not accessible through the traditional referral pipelines, but really needed hospice. And then leaders had to learn. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, when you talk about that, you know, we're going to touch here in a little bit on workforce restrictions and what have you. And it was such a large component. And even the other supporting resources, right? It's not just about obviously the patient, but the family caregiver, the extension of that care, spiritual support, et cetera, all had issues with that. And so, I'll be interested to hear your perspectives on what that meant by way of the restrictions and what happened there in the workforce.
Sure. Another evolution for all of us as hospice leaders was how to learn to manage the increased operating costs associated with new technology, the cost of PPE, staff incentives that we had to offer, enhanced PRN or contract staff that we had to hire, and overtime due to quarantine staff. Medicare was not reimbursing, has not obviously reimbursed any of us for these pandemic equipment and supplies. And hospice leadership had to learn how to effectively manage the productivity of remote administrative staff who were working from home, oftentimes on newly adopted technology. And finally, I would say hospice had to become creative to manage a sense of team when the staff wasn't able to get together. And for hospice, that time together, that interdisciplinary team, it's really a time for sharing, it's a time for grieving, it's a time for celebrating. It's really integral to the hospice model, and that was deeply felt by the hospice teams.
Yeah, and that's a perfect segue into really starting to talk about that workforce restriction and the interdisciplinary teams and the way they were used to working cohesively together, and really what it meant to be, as you put it, creative. Certainly we've heard the creativity that's been involved and some of the really profound things that have been done in the hospice workplace and how you've had to be extra creative with utilizing new technologies to work around, simply just being told, no, you can't be on site somewhere. So with that, a little bit more about the aspects of that, we'd love to hear what you've heard, what you felt, and how you specifically helped in being able to work around that workforce restriction within the hospice space.
Sure. I really appreciated this question as I was preparing this presentation because it really gave me time to reflect on the multitude of workforce restrictions that we went through in the last year and a half. The first one really is that the hospice industry has to be capable of responding flexibly and rapidly to the pandemic. And although I feel that the patient's needs were met under basic tenets of hospice, I believe that some aspects were truly made hospice individualized and compassionate were sacrificed to some extent as we tried to work our way through the pandemic. Hospice is about comfort, touch, and togetherness, and these are in direct opposition to what we're being asked to do in the pandemic. And hospice is obviously about gathering loved ones around that dying patient and sharing that dying experience with them. So in addition, our dedicated hospice staff, I mentioned this a little bit in the previous question, but our dedicated hospice staff really had some lingering grief and senses of guilt of not being able to do more for their patients and families. Yet even hospice care workers have found that their professional lives were altered in unimaginable ways, right? So that a lot of our employees were struggling with children that were remote schooling, lack of daycare. And so it really became very challenging for our staff, and clinicians had a lot of lingering anguish over not being able to help more with the empty sadness of moving towards death alone.
I'm sorry. I was going to say, and with that, when you talk about, the guilt that comes along with that and breeding that, additional creativity, you mentioned here facilities not referring to hospice. And what did you see by way of, any sort of burden or any sort of biggest disruption, I guess you can call it, within that pipeline and within, ensuring that you create a real steady flow and stream of communication with the families?
Yeah, so obviously our telephone communications with families, we as an agency operationalized our telehealth. We had iPads that we operationalized out into the facilities, not only for our clinicians to use, but also for the facilities who really weren't prepared for this, so that they could interface the patient with their loved ones in the home. But we did a lot of that as well with our telehealth, making sure that we were bringing remote family members in with conversations around advanced care planning, symptom management issues. And we were also able to bring in primary care physicians as well as medical directors when there were concerns about treatment options. So it was really, that's how we stayed connected. We had many facilities that didn't allow any disciplines in. Most facilities would allow at least the nurse and possibly the aide, but almost 100% of our social work and chaplain visits were remote. And so our video as well as our telecommunications were really essential in helping support those families and patients with their spiritual and emotional needs. And you add the complicated factor with patients in facilities where the loved ones weren't allowed to visit and see their loved ones for months on end. It was very challenging. The families relied on us to be their eyes and ears and their support, and more so than ever before.
Yeah. Yeah. And with that, you mentioned the increased emotional support needs, to the staff. Obviously, there's a big burden to carry. You mentioned some of the guilt that comes along with it. And really, such a unique individual, caring individual, the hospice, nurse, and wanting to do something but not being able to, right, because of all the guidelines, because of all the different mechanisms in place, for the protection of both the family and the patient. And so, certainly I could see that. And that's why I asked, is because of what we've heard. It wasn't one and the same across the board, right? It was all that creativity, as you mentioned, being different in each siloed, organization, having different protocols. And so it was kind of learning as you navigated throughout, and still, I think, learning even today as we navigate, up through and hopefully beyond the pandemic.
Right.
Yep.
Absolutely. Yep.
Yep. Absolutely. So with that, when you talk about staffing, just going back to that, I think, that's going to be a big theme here on what we really wanted to cover and what you and I had discussed a little bit more offline, thinking about the outlook for staffing in hospice and what it means and what the nature that looks like today with being such a critical component, right? We mentioned having that very unique and special employee in hospice and palliative care, and retention and everything else that goes along with it. So talk to us a little bit more, if you could share about the outlook for staffing in hospice.
Sure. There's a lot of challenges, right? Because of our aging population, the baby boomers that are actually coming into healthcare now, these are the individuals that are between the dates of 1946 and 1964. So these are the individuals currently coming into the healthcare system. And the anticipation is that there's about 70 million of these people in this category currently, second only to the millennials. And this presents an opportunity and a challenge. These individuals will need long-term home care and hospice services in the next few years. And so there's going to be a massive impact to Social Security and Medicare, and obviously our healthcare system. And combine this with the fact that people are living longer with chronic illness, there's expected to be a huge push in the demand for home health and hospice of about a 75% increase. And so the other interesting fact that I found in preparing for this for a number is that without medical breakthrough, those living with Alzheimer's disease could triple in number by 2050 and represent about 14 million people. So it's that coupled with the rise in utilization of hospice, which is wonderful, right? In 2018, Medicare, there were 51% of Medicare beneficiaries utilizing hospice, which was the highest ever in hospice utilization. You add that to the aging of our clinicians, and the estimate I believe out there is that about a half of our nursing force will be expected to retire within the next 10 years. And then our nurses and social workers that are graduating and being trained out there before they come into the field are really not receiving hospice and palliative care training. So then you couple all of that, the staffing concerns, and you add on the experience that we've had with the pandemic, which has, you know, sort of magnified our staffing issues. And that's happened because it's difficult right now for us to find non-hospice specialists and train them. It's very difficult to find them. And then there's, because of the pandemic, there's been a higher psychological impact to the providers that are actually in the field with depression and insomnia and anxiety and lots of things that they're dealing with because of out of the course of their care providing. There's been a challenge on staffing with FMLA, and we previously talked about the remote schooling and daycare challenges. And then our retiring clinicians, a lot of them are leaving the industry early and opting for remote positions, because as you have the older clinicians, they may be entering age categories where they're at higher risk. And finally, one of the things that I was interfacing with as a program director was a lot of these student programs, a lot of the students that were in their last year of their programs and typically would have been in some type of clinical placement, were not. And so their training was tremendously interrupted and impacted. And a lot of those students, unfortunately, are starting to rethink whether they want to be in this career or not. And so I feel like the gap created will be felt for many years, and I'm concerned for the future of staffing for hospice based on what we traditionally looked at as the traditional model of care.
Yeah, and so when you mention, you know, the adaptation required because of the interruption in, you know, academia and what's happened, right, all throughout, everything clearly, you know, took a pause at some point, which clearly pushed the next generation of the hospital staff. So what recommendations would you provide, or what is your take on the adaptation that you think is necessary, and how you guys plan to go about, again, being creative due to the interruption with the next level hospice nurse?
Yeah, so, you know, certainly the next hospice nurse, obviously, our training is going to be different. You know, the need for more in-depth orientation. One of the things that we strive for with our new hires is to have them be hospice and palliative care certified within a couple of years of being in the department. So really working on probably longer preceptorships with these individuals and making sure that they're receiving the support that they need and the experience that they need and the training around best practices. So it's going to require more intensive training. I also believe that typically in hospice, people have been reluctant to hire new grads out of school. But I believe the future for staffing is going to require that we need to be focusing on bringing new talent into the hospice fold. For years, in the 33 years I've been involved in hospice and palliative care, we've had the luxury of having people that have really come up through the ranks of acute care, long-term care, and we've been able to pluck them into hospice But I don't think with the nursing force that we are looking at retiring about half of them in the next 10 years, we're going to have to be looking at investing in our new talent.
Yep. Yeah, which really brings us, tapers nicely to our next topic area, which is telehealth. And so before we jump into this, I think to kind of put a bookmark on, you know, the staffing and hospice and the outlook that you just provided and gave insight to, it's looking at it from a different lens, right? It's not necessarily coming from that, you know, acute space and you know, navigating in through the ranks of hospice. It's looking at the new next generation and those who are technically savvy, those who have embraced technology and those who have, you know, embraced it to the point that it's part of their everyday lives. And so it's not that it's even, you know, unfamiliar, but it would be, you know, almost out of line to not use a type of technology like that because they're so accustomed to it. One of the things that we hear, Jody, kind of across the board really is the way and how meaningful it is, rather, the way it's interpreted from the provider clinician level to the patient and the caregiver, how they embrace it, right? It's very transparent whether or not it's meaningful to them and they believe in the technology and they think it's going to be an improvement in the quality of care. But having used it every day and being in that mindset and being that type of kind of new, fresher, you know, type of talent who utilizes technology every day, I think it's critically important to really be able to articulate and really believe in what you're doing to extend the reach of care.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. So with that, let's talk more about extending the reach, you know, across the board, really, for clinicians who are currently in the field.
Sure. The COVID pandemic has actually had a profound effect on hospice, as we've already talked about, and hospice has had to adapt to the public health emergency in ways that will continue to mold the care that they're providing, as well as shape their business operations for years to come. So by adopting telehealth, providers can manage health outcomes across populations of patients. And we've seen that through our experience in the COVID pandemic. And I'll just touch upon a few things that we found in the program that I led is that telehealth really helped us increase our access to care by allowing the case managers to talk to patients about chronic disease management while promoting in-person visits for high acuity or high symptom management cases. And on-demand access helped caregivers when they're experiencing problems when caring for patients. In addition, it helped improve what we felt was the quality of care. That telehealth facilitated quicker assessments of symptoms and escalations of symptoms or functional declines that the patient was experiencing and allowing more timely, effective interventions for those. It also helped engage our patients and caregivers. So the engagement component is really important to all of us as hospice providers as we start and palliative care providers as we enter our value-based purchasing environment, that we need to be making sure that we're engaging patients and families in a way that meets their values. So telehealth really gave us opportunities for teaching, allowed us to bring multiple participants, multiple family members onto virtual visits. And some of those virtual visits actually involved all the IDT members in our case and allowed goals of care conversations to happen. It helped reduce some of the challenges that we have around geographical. A lot of our hospices are large organizations now, and we're spanning a large geographic area, and our patients live in very rural areas. So it's essential for hospice to offer individualized communication and information. So telehealth can help us do that and access that patient-provider relationship and help manage those patients' health issues and eliminate traveling challenges that hospice staff have. In addition, telehealth helped us reduce costs by improving staff productivity while improving quality and optimize the clinical resources in those rural areas when you know, time was of the essence to meet those patient needs. And again, yep. Prioritizing, it helped us prioritize those in-person visits because obviously telehealth is not going to take the place of all visits, but we needed to, especially during the pandemic when we were struggling with staffing, we needed to make sure that we optimized those in-person visits for those patients that needed them. And so telehealth really provided us with that while at the same time allowing us to intervene on issues that patients were having outside of that in-person visit. It improved productivity particularly in the evening visits, after hour visits and weekends, and reduce caregiver utilization of the emergency room, which again is another value-based purchasing idea out there that they're looking to reduce overall healthcare costs. It also helped reduce caregiver stress. Telehealth really allowed us to provide that live in-person training when that caregiver really needed it the most. A lot of times in the middle of the night, when they could really reach out to us and have that voice out there that they knew that they could talk to. And we gave them not only things to do and things to intervene, but also encouraged them and built them up and told them that they were doing a good job. And because caregiving during the pandemic was really a very lonely position to be in. It also, I feel, increased care adherence, because that face-to-face with the provider and that ability for that patient and family to reach back out to that provider really sort of developed that sense of almost an agreement that they knew that we were checking in, they knew they were there for support, and it wasn't one of these situations where they were not going to do something that we asked them to do. Or maybe they were afraid to do because they knew that they could reach out and get clarification. And then finally, I think one of the big things that I saw during the pandemic was really our ability to use telehealth to provide that emotional, psychosocial, and spiritual support of patients and families, particularly facility patients, when our social workers and chaplains were requested to be remote during that care time.
Yeah. Yeah, and when you talk about, you know, the increase in adherence, I don't think that's anecdotal. I think that's something that's consistent with what we see and hear, you know, across the spectrum, which is the majority of communications, just as you and I talk now via video, is nonverbal, right? And
right.
So it's the adherence, it's being able to see in their eyes and their face and their expressions and all that goes along with the majority of communications being nonverbal. So with that, I don't think that's anything new. I don't think that's anything that would, you know, shake anybody up as a fact. I just think it's an extension of what would normally be a face-to-face conversation and having the peace of mind and the assurance, really, from knowing that it's on demand. It's on demand help. It's on demand spiritual guidance. It's on demand X, right? Whatever is needed at any time, at any place, because they're in the comfort of their homes, because that is the time and need, and it's readily available right then and there versus waiting the next day, waiting for the weekend to pass, what have you. So 100% agree, Jody, we hear it, we see it. I don't think it's anecdotal whatsoever. I think certainly with the majority of communication being nonverbal, I just think that extends so far beyond what any phone conversation could ever provide.
Yeah, and I think the on-demand nature is, I mean, we could have, in some cases, when our clinicians arrived in person, it might not have been at a time when that caregiver had that need, you know? So it's mm-hmm. the ability to, maybe we made an in-person visit on that day, but the ability to have that real-time reach out, I have a question now, really made a big difference. And really made us open our eyes around that real need for that family to have that personal connection and be able to reach out and get those questions answered.
Absolutely. When and where they needed it. Absolutely.
Right. Right.
And so with that, you know, prioritization is a critical component here because, frankly, there's always going to be the need, right? Should it be
right.
a hybrid model or what have you? It's never a full-on replacement, so to speak.
Right.
And so this is obviously a hot topic to many of the folks who are looking to take on another type of, you know, technology, virtual communication, what have you. In that certainly it's not a full and direct replacement. It's
sure.
more to augment. It's more to be there on the fly, just as you just alluded to there. So with that, let's talk more about, you know, prioritization of hospice visits, why it's critically important, obviously, to have a protocol in place and what that balance looks like.
Sure. So there were sort of, as I was thinking about this, I was thinking about what we actually did as a program. And so, you know, overall, hospice organizations had to develop new protocols that balance the need of hands-on care with the safety of staff and families. That was our big challenge during COVID. The COVID pandemic has demonstrated that hospices that they need to be more, they need to be quicker with their decision-making. They need to be more flexible. And there were many challenges that necessitated visit prioritization, including staffing, as we've talked about, visitor restrictions, PPE supplies, and shortages. So one of the things that hospices have to do as part of Department of Public Health and advanced accreditation is we need to have an emergency preparedness acuity designation. And this is utilized as part of our emergency preparedness to identify patients with low and high and moderate risk. So we naturally have an acuity designation that we review on a regular basis. It really should be reviewed at every IDT. And by adopting this acuity triage system, clinicians can determine which patients require in-person visitation and how frequently they need that. And which patients really, we adopted it to really reflect on which patients at their current level of care could really benefit from a virtual visit versus in-person visit. So that was one. The other thing that we had to consider as we prioritized hospice visits was really the staff that we had currently on staff that were at high risk. They might have been in an age category mm-hmm. or had some of those, you know, serious medical conditions or complications. So as we were triaging visits and how we were going to, you know, those may have been case managers for certain caseloads. So we really had to do a lot of moving around and dynamics around that to protect our staff as well. In addition, PPE, we all know that PPE was very difficult and very expensive to get. So we really had to, as we prioritized hospice visits, we had to look at how we optimized our PPE, especially in our facility visits and making sure that we tried to designate teams in particular facilities. Maybe we only had staff go in on certain days in one building to see all the COVID positive patients. So there were different ways that we would optimize our use of PPE, and certainly we tracked it and monitored how it was being distributed very closely. The other thing that we had to track very closely was really our COVID positive patients and our staff. We were very lucky that we had very few staff that became COVID positive, but we had to really track where our COVID positive patients were. A lot of those patients were moving around in our facility that we were seeing, and we really needed to track and make sure that we were prioritizing how those visits would happen and how staff would be visiting those individuals. And then a big piece of a lot of our time was spent on collaborating with facilities. We needed to really understand their concerns. And one of the early challenges were when CMS came out and said, well, you know, long-term care facilities can allow essential employees in their door. Unfortunately, a lot of long-term care facilities decided that hospice clinicians were non-essential, and so they closed their doors. And so CMS was not terribly clear on that differentiation, so that became a challenge as we had conversations with these facilities and prioritizing care. Oftentimes, as I mentioned before, we were sort of keeping certain staff in certain buildings. We were limiting our visitations for certain days with COVID patients and different days with non-COVID patients. And then obviously our social workers and chaplains and volunteers many times were not allowed in the buildings. And then finally, the next couple of things were really about the COVID protocols per facility. We had to understand those as we were working, because some of them required monthly testing, some were weekly, some were every other week, and we had to make mm-hmm. sure that our staff were up to date with that, and we needed to understand, in addition, their PPE protocols. And then so finally, you know, and most importantly, you know, COVID-19 really has fast-forwarded our digital health transformation across all of hospice and across healthcare in general. And so creating that meaningful human connection has required creativity and innovation. We've already touched upon that. So telephonic follow-up triage calls and video calls with audio, replacing those in-person visits. So in the idea of prioritizing, we were monitoring clinical signs and symptoms of certain conditions remotely. We were doing advanced care planning conversations and goals of cares remotely. Mm-hmm. We were doing environmental home safety checks remotely. We were providing non-emergent care to long-term care facilities. In addition, education and training for healthcare proxy and caregivers, as well as facility staff. So one unique thing that we did, and maybe not so unique, maybe there's a lot of agencies out there that did it, but when we only were allowed to have a nurse and an aide in a building, oftentimes that nurse would bring up the virtual call while she was there with the patient, and we would interface at that time with the chaplain and the social worker. So we were trying to be very creative on how we prioritized our visitations.
Yeah, and we tend to hear that as far as, decreasing the burden of the technology hurdle, if you will, with one of your staff members being more familiar with it, and again, embracing the technology and bringing it in bedside, if you will, yep. to be able to engage with the multiple interdisciplinary, units there. And so one thing I want to go back to, Jody, is you mentioned, such a large concern as it is today, which is, COVID testing protocols by facility, because they're siloed, because they're different, because they're unique in nature, and everybody was trying to figure out, what was what by way of what the appropriate protocol was. How were you guys able to track and monitor that so as to build, was that a database, or how did you compile that data, and what did that look like as far as any sort of, fluidity to it?
Yeah, so we created a dynamic document. At our particular agency, we would have a morning huddle every morning. And so we created a spreadsheet, and by way of our liaisons or our case manager who was in the facility, that spreadsheet would get updated on a daily basis. And a lot of it fluctuated based on the facility's experience with positive cases or a positive staff member in their facility. So sometimes they would go from, once a month to once a week based on some type of trending that they were seeing. And also they were on calls with DPH all the time. So they were left to sort of interpret a lot of times what they needed to do internally. So we really needed to stay very close with them as far as what their requirements were. And again, sometimes that prioritized the visits, right? So maybe nurse A hadn't had her COVID test done yet, so we had to send nurse B. So, you're looking at, it was definitely a dynamic process. It was a day-to-day process of managing staff and managing facility expectations.
Yeah, so it sounds like, certainly there was a lot learned there by way of not just prioritization, but also staffing, analysis on, who can go where and when and who the most appropriate resource is. And I'd imagine that was something that was a daunting task. Right. And you mentioned, I think you put it mildly there, that it sounds like a huge undertaking in collaboration with those facilities. But it also sounds like that would also help to solidify, again, furthering that relationship with making sure that your staffing is appropriate for the use case, for the patient, in adherence with the PPE protocols and all of it. And so I think from both sides there, it was a learning process, it sounds like, and ultimately successful collaboration, leads to a stronger relationship with all those facilities, I'm sure.
Absolutely.
Yep. Yeah. So, with that, talking a little bit about or shifting a little bit to the gaps, clearly there are gaps, we hear about by way of navigating and the patient, and that transitional process up through, the post-acute home health palliative and then through to hospice care. Share with us, if you could, why that is the case and what are some of the things that you guys have identified and ways in which you can work through some of those gaps in the bridge through that process.
Sure. So I'll talk about first just some of the gaps that we've seen, and then some of the things that I feel where telehealth can be really instrumental in helping us with this. And certainly you're going to see themes through this, and as we go from this slide to talk about value-based purchasing and quadruple aim and just sort of think about these gaps and how all of this interfaces. It's all really, in my mind, very interconnected. So, our healthcare system right now is very siloed and fragmented, which that really means that a lot of our chronically ill patients are being seen by multiple specialists. And so they're each of those specialists, the patient's on an individual track, you know, with their care. And a lot of times there isn't communication and there isn't an electronic medical record that allows coordination of that care. And many of these patients are seen by physicians in multiple organizations. So it becomes this very siloed care model where nobody really taking accountability for that patient and that patient's overall care. And so a lot of things happen because of that, right? Well, I thought so-and-so made the referral to palliative. No, so-and-so mm-hmm. should have done the referral to hospice. I thought you had that goals of care or advanced care planning conversation with this patient. So there's a lot of things that fall out when we have siloed and fragmented healthcare. And now with the value-based purchasing models, the primary goal is around care coordination. So you're going to be seeing more the identifying of that fragmented healthcare. And just segueing again to that is just the advanced care planning, which I already talked about, is that it's really important that we have these conversations earlier in the patient's care, because these conversations are a process. It's not a split second decision that a patient makes that I'm this is what I'm going to decide for myself. It's a series of conversations that patient needs to have. Around family acceptance around hospice, there's a lot of confusion around terminology. Even physicians sometimes have difficulty explaining the difference between hospice and palliative care. There's religious and cultural preferences that affect that. A lot of people feel that hospice is only for cancer patients or it hastens my death. There's a fear around the utilization of morphine. That there's a fear that they're going to lose control over their care options if they choose hospice, or it means that they're giving up hope. So it's really, there's a lot of things around the patient and family acceptance around hospice that make it difficult to get that patient in the right position for care at end of life. The next one is really the physician acceptance, right? The data shows that The longer the patient and physician relationship, the harder it is for that physician to refer that patient to hospice or palliative care. And that's understandable, right? It's become personal. This relationship, they've had a long-standing relationship. And the physicians are trained to cure. They're not trained in really what they identify as failure when they don't have something to do for a patient. And so a lot of times they're hesitant to talk about hospice and palliative care because they feel like they're going to be, the patient's going to feel they're abandoning them or that they can't handle their care needs. They may feel like they're going to lose control of their patient when they refer the patient to a specialty service. And again, a lot of physicians are uncomfortable broaching the end of life conversations and often refer patients really in the final weeks and days of their life, which really the family does not benefit from the hospice benefit or the palliative care. The next one is really the hospice payment model, which we are actually seeing changing with some of the VBID models. But patients and families right now are being asked to choose between curative treatment and hospice. And so oftentimes that leads to patients and families choosing hospice at the end of life. And the other thing is that 6 months or less timeframe for physicians can be challenging. And so they get so worried about really honing into that last 6 months that oftentimes what we're seeing is the patient is in the last month of their life before we get a referral. Training, you know, we talk about training. We talked about training around new staff. You know, there is not, you know, 1 in 3 medical schools and social work programs and nursing programs provide palliative and hospice care training. So we don't have a lot of people coming into the field with that mindset. Social determinants of health, extremely important as you look at palliative and hospice care and how we're reaching our racial and ethnic communities. The access to care we know is less than what we'd like to see. And our racial and ethnic communities typically have higher rates of comorbidity. So these are the populations that really need our help. They tend to seek preventative care and diagnostic care less. And a lot of times that's out of a distrust for the healthcare system or a dissatisfaction with care that they've already received. There's oftentimes religious and cultural barriers and language barriers. a lot of our staff, you know, out there may or may not be culturally competent, and really knowing what those cultures want, and particularly right. around end of life care. And finally, there's socioeconomic issues that certainly are of a concern. And I would say the last thing that we saw a lot of was really in this SNF and ALF environment of just really having difficulties around lack of protocols around discussing decline of the patients on a regular basis, and really understanding the hospice benefit and how we could collaborate with them at end of life to help with their patient care. So that, in a nutshell, very quickly, are really some of the major gaps that I see.
Yep. Yeah. And I've seen the studies out there with the disparities in you know, socioeconomic groups and what have you. And it definitely reflects some of those challenges that you've mentioned, which is important that it's been identified, and some of those care coordination gaps and things that can be done and what have you. And so, you know, I would venture to say there's also other readings that I've seen where, you know, I do see some creativity at work there with first identifying, and now they've been identified, to go out and, you know, proactively solicit to certain groups and rural communities and what have you, who may not otherwise have thought about that type of care. Like you said, some felt it was only for cancer patients, right? Those right. type of, you know, misconceptions. So, yeah. So let's move to the quadruple aim in hospice. Obviously, very, very hot and relevant topic here. So if you could walk us through, you know, quadruple aim, what is it for those who aren't as aware? And we'll take it from there.
Yeah. So particularly for hospice, I tried to really customize this for the four aims around hospice, is really improving the health of populations, particularly obviously in our older chronically ill adults and terminally ill, by coordinating the services that we're providing around their unique and individual needs. And then the second leg of the stool is really the patient experience. This is through, and hospice does this through, patient-centered care planning and efficient, effective communication strategies and data-driven, evidence-based best practices. And the third leg is really the cost savings, right? We're looking at sort of maintaining that Medicare health benefit and reducing the burden of cost on our healthcare system. So hospice is really focused on helping families make decisions around their care to reduce the utilization of futile and aggressive treatments, and really reduce that acute care rehospitalization, and really eliminate any of those burdensome transitions, so that the patient is experiencing that end of life the way they want it. And then finally, and we'll talk about this in a future slide, but really the importance of employee engagement, and by driving that meaningful mm-hmm. work, which connects clinicians to their purpose as healers and supports their professionalism, it's essential that we engage our employees and retain them in the hard work and rewarding work of hospice and palliative care.
Yeah, and you mentioned the value-based, you know, purchasing, and obviously with the hospice services, while still reducing costs, critically important. You have to do it one and the same. Obviously, I'm sure that's several components to that, which we could probably have a whole other presentation on. But if you could just briefly, walk us through some of the value-based purchasing in hospice and why that's such a critical component, with spending less for better outcomes.
Yeah. So the model that's out now is the VBID model, is really about trying to increase access to hospice services, reduce costs, and facilitate better care coordination between patients and hospice providers. So you can already see some of that overlap of the VBP with the quadruple aim. And so it's really why I feel VBID is important, is that it's really looking at spending less for better outcomes. You know, patients will have fewer costs and fewer futile treatments and fewer ER visits. So we will be looking, from a value-based purchasing standpoint, of really targeting the care for patients. It also focuses on increasing patient satisfaction and improving communication, making your agency culturally engaging, optimizing scheduling, all of those kinds of things that really engage the patient and bring value to the patient and family and caregiver. Also improving care coordination, so incentives and improved technologies that really enable providers to coordinate that care. And that's where telehealth also comes in here, is The integration produced by that collaborative care creates better outcomes for the patient because all of their healthcare providers work together. And so, what also enters into here, which partners with telehealth, is interoperability as well as predictive analytics. Reducing healthcare costs and improving care, where fewer people need costly care, total healthcare spending decreases. And then finally, the VBID also looks at strong cost control and reducing risk for payers. So the new models are really linking hospice and home health closely to payers. So lower costs across the board mean that insurance companies have to pay less money for their services, and it allows payers to increase efficiency by bundling payments that cover patients' chronic illness.
Yeah, and really tying it into those outcomes,
right.
You know, certainly critical component there, which overall the quality of that care is shown. So right. In the role of technology there, when you talk about, quadruple aim, improving outcomes, I know you place a lot of emphasis on this because clearly that's the ultimate goal is to drive efficiencies, yes, to reduce costs, yes, but ultimately for the improvement of outcomes. And
right.
So, just briefly mention, if you could, why that is the critical component to this.
Yes. So improving outcomes is really about three things: driving interoperability, which really helps us communicate. I talked previously about EHRs not communicating with each other, the challenge of getting all that information about that patient that has now come to you for hospice and palliative care, and really being able to have all that information and know what's been done for that patient so that you're providing high quality, safe patient care. So interoperability is essential. And then using predictive analytics is really looking at population health, taking what has happened, what we know about previous patient populations, accumulating that data and using that data to really augment clinical decision making. So it's like an extra tool in the nurse's tool bag, and it just helps optimize that nurse's decision making around what she should do for this patient at this point in time, given the clinical parameters that she's seeing. And so it's really using that machine learning and predictive analytics about that patient, about the patient population, and extrapolating that to the patient in front and really optimizing the care. And then telehealth, again, I would say this is like the third leg of the stool for me, is really it improves quality of life by improving outcomes and reduces acute care rehospitalization. Telehealth enables us to position ourselves to meet the growing needs of a diverse population and allows hospices to help the most patients at the least cost. So it increases access to care, as we've talked about before. It makes care more effective by bridging the gap in care where providers can obtain additional support for symptom management. And it engages patients. Telehealth can be used for outreach, reminders. We oftentimes used it for medication reminders. We've used it for reminders for caregivers around repositioning patients. So telehealth really adds additional bandwidth to this aim of value-based purchasing and improving outcomes.
Yep, and improving outcome while keeping the family obviously in tune with what's happening, with what's going on.
Right.
You mentioned briefly before I turn it over here about social determinants of health, right? A couple slides back, we were talking about that and about the disparities there and utilizing the information. So with the interoperability also comes the on-demand, social determinants of health data, overall, what is to be expected, likelihood, things like that. And so when you start looking at different risk factors being served up for you with that type of technology and having it on demand and on the fly, I think that is of critical importance, again, to have a clinician who has that level of information, right, that type of power on demand and readily available when engaging, with a patient, whether virtual or not, certainly that's a huge component.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And so with that, enhancing the patient family experience would come along with that. So if you could talk to us here about the six domains.
Sure. So just really quickly going over that the six domains for great patient experience, these are all really, I'm sure everybody will nod as I talk about them, is really safe care, avoiding harm to patients for the care that's intended to help them. and the care is expected to be effective. It should be evidence-based practice. It should be patient and family-centered, and that's really what hospice and palliative care do the best. Our care planning is all centered around the patient and family. And the care should be timely, and that's one of the challenges as we talked about the gaps in hospice referrals, is we want to make sure that we're getting that patient upstream in their care needs so that they're fully benefiting from the benefit. The care mm-hmm. should be efficient. Hospice is designed around a capitated system where financial benefits are derived from the providers working with the patient. So as we're able to work with that patient and provide the best possible care and reduce acute care hospitalization, that's efficient care. And then equitable care, it's, again, the hospice has an opportunity to demonstrate value to payers by spotlighting known social barriers that drive poor outcomes and offer innovative solutions. Many of these are oftentimes non-medical, non-clinical solutions. So it might be transportation, it might be meals, it might be, and again, the VBID model is now encompassing some of those concepts of it's things that we've known as home care and hospice providers for years. We've seen what the barriers have been. We've seen the challenges of what sent a patient into the hospital, but there hasn't been really a payment model or support model for those services.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so with that, you know, the role of that type of technology and what that means for the last component, which of course, one of the critical components, which is lowering costs.
Right.
All this is great. And you mentioned, you know, reimbursement, you mentioned by way of capitated system. So talk to us about the lowering of the cost. Obviously, it's a critical component. We probably don't need to explain that. But what it means in the scope of planning for this and the protocols put into place.
Yeah. So obviously, in talking about the gaps in hospice, it's really critical that we get earlier hospice referrals, earlier in the upstream care of the patient, making sure those advanced care planning conversations are happening, making sure that we're getting rid of any of those myths or misconceptions or eliminating those knowledge deficits, and also breaking down the walls of siloed care. And then again, predictive analytics are going to be extremely helpful as we move into controlling costs, because if we understand the cost per patient by diagnosis and we're able to drive best practices related to that, the data that we can have, it's amazing and really can provide the best possible care. And then again, telehealth is extremely important and helping us reduce emergency room visits by intervening with that patient, the on-demand nature of it, where the caregiver can reach out when in the middle of the night when they're having questions about what they should do around symptom management, instead of them immediately picking up the phone and calling the ambulance and sending their loved one into the hospital. Those benefits of reducing cost are tremendously important in this model of care.
Yep. Yeah, absolutely. And having, again, going back to the on-demand, on-the-fly type of communication, access, I think just really does change things by way of the peace of mind, the comfort, the reassurance of knowing that should you need, right, to go to the ED, absolutely you can go. However, you can always make a call should it be a non-emergency or non-life-threatening right then and there to be able to make a quick phone call. And have a virtual interaction. Right. So with that, Jody, I notice here employee satisfaction. It ties right in. We probably could have put it just after that right. earlier slide with workforce.
Right.
Such a critical component. We've really hammered this hard, but I think rightly so, because more so than ever, it's going to require a change in what the previous, whether you want to call them recruiting or what have you, the hospice nurse looks like, right? So not necessarily coming from the acute space, but you mentioned that. So without the fourth leg, I'll let you talk a little bit more about why that's critically important and give some last words to the employee satisfaction and why that's so important.
Yeah, and again, the goal of healthcare is to make it safe, effective, patient-centered, timely, and efficient, and equitable. And it starts by developing high-functioning patient-centered teams and satisfied staff leads to satisfied patients. And Don Berwick put it really well in saying joy is our resource for excellence. So really, we need to we need to create joy in the work that we're doing and making sure that we're recruiting and retaining top talent. And so, you know, the current model, the fee-for-service model, really forces providers to spend less time with patients. And obviously in hospice, that's not the case, but then globally, it's reimbursing providers for seeing more patients. And so what we really need to get back to is really sort of that time with that patient being critical and reserve that time and being able to have that provider feel like they're affecting a change with that patient and family. And that's where the joy comes from. And so it really is about focusing on patient value, patient experience, the cost and quality of care. So that's where that value-based purchasing and quadruple aim intersects. And so value-based health really needs, the clinicians need to find their purpose as healers and support their professionalism. And it can be a powerful mechanism to counteract clinician burnout. So it's really, again, it could be a topic in and of itself, but predictive analytics, interoperability, and telehealth all help. And telehealth really can stretch our staff in new ways to expand access to care and allow our providers to feel like they're providing really top-notch care for their patients and families. So again, it's those three legs of the stool that I see running through value-based as well as quadruple aim.
Yep, absolutely. Well put, Jody. So with that, I didn't see any questions. I just checked a second ago there. You're extremely thorough, and we appreciate that as well, Jody. But great way to end today's spotlight and discussion, talking about, you know, the employee satisfaction, what it means, why it's so critically important. And again, Jody, you know, we'd like to thank you for sharing your perspectives regarding super timely topic in healthcare. And we do sincerely appreciate your time that you've invested with us today and leading up to this spotlight discussion. So with that, today's session was sponsored by Cinzi. Should you want to learn more, go to cinzi.com to sign up for a free custom demo. And this concludes our Cinzi spotlight presentation today. Thank you, Jody. Thank you so much. And we appreciate your time and interest.
Thank you.
Thank you.